welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I have with me on the line from Boulder City, Nevada, Dr. Douglas Merkler. He's a resource soil scientist for Southern and Eastern Nevada with USDA and Natural Resources Conservation Service. He's a fourth generation Nevadan and the resource soil scientist for Southern and Eastern Nevada with USDA. His great-grandfather settled in the Elko area in 1877, establishing what became one of the larger sheep ranches in Nevada, and he was awarded the Soil Scientist of the Year nationally for the USDA in 2004, and he currently runs the Technical Soil Services Program for Nevada. Dr. Merkler is presenting a webinar this Tuesday. It's entitled Soil Basics and How Utah is Adapting. If you would like to register for the webinar, you can find more information at forestry.usu.edu. Dr. Merkler, I interview extension specialists quite a bit, but when I saw the title of your webinar that's upcoming, I thought, okay, this would be a good opportunity to bring in an outside source and talk a little bit about soils and how they affect how we live. So why don't you address a little bit what you do for a living and how that correlates to this webinar and what you'll be bringing to the webinar.
Okay. I am a soil scientist, and I have been actively mapping in the basin and range for about 36 years. And when I say mapping, I mean I've been mapping soils and plant assemblages throughout much of the basin and range. That's been almost all in Nevada, except with the exception of a little bit in the Grand Canyon. So this has been a really fun journey, I guess, for me to be able to have that much time in the field. It's been just really wonderful. And then in the later part of my career, I guess I've evolved a little bit more into a consultant for units of government. The technical soil service part of my title, the resource part of my title, really addresses that.
And your family has been in the West for quite a while.
Yes, I'm a fourth generation Nevadan from a ranch in the Ruby Mountains near Elko. So my great-grandfather settled near Fort Halleck in the Ruby Mountains in 1877. And then his son, my grandfather, continued with the ranching business that was a complex of about five ranches. And so I don't know, you know, I guess in a simplistic sense, I have sagebrush in my blood. There's no doubt about it.
So why soils? Why did you focus on soils? What led you that direction?
Well, I didn't know at first. I ended up making a list as I was about to enter into college, and it wasn't a list I showed anyone else. It was a list that I liked and things that were important to me. I didn't share this with anyone else, just myself. And I had this list of all of the things that I liked, and I liked botany, and I liked geology. I loved climatology. And so there was a couple revelations at the end of the list when I kind of got done. As I looked at it, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I think maybe the first thing I should do on my list is get therapy. There were, like, a lot of things on there, and it was kind of complicated. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of stuff. And then I took the college course catalog, and I went through, and I marked the course of study in the catalog for college that had more of the items on my list than any other. And I ended up coming up with two things. One was biochemistry, and the other one is the science of soils, which is the science of pedology. And very happy that I went through that process. I have been very fortunate to be working at something that I love passionately pretty much for my adult life.
I have with me on the line from Boulder City, Nevada, we have Douglas Merkler. He is a resource soil scientist from Southern and Eastern Nevada with USDA and Natural Resources Conservation Service, and we're talking about soils. Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask is just, you know, get down to the basics, even though we talk about it all the time. What exactly is soil? And I'm always correcting people when they say dirt. It's like, no, it's soil. So let's look at the basics of soil.
Well, that's a really good question. I like the way that's couched. I think that we generally don't really think much about soil. In fact, soil probably has a negative connotation generally. We talk about something being soiled, or we call it dirt, and we wash it out of our clothes and off our bodies. Where in reality, soil is a three-dimensional living thing, and it's this three-dimensionality of the skin of our earth that is so critical. I would say that probably dirt is soil out of place.
So it's composed of several different things. You say it's living.
Oh, it is. The biological aspect of soils is critical, and one of the things I often will correct my colleagues in the geosciences is they refer a lot of times to soil as being rotten rock, you know, this weathered rock. Well, that's not untrue, but it is alive, and it's the organisms that occur within soil that really link it to being the primary provider of ecosystem services on our planet. And so the number of microbes in a teaspoon can number in the billions. The geochemical recycling of all these critical nutrients for our planet happen primarily in the soil. The largest amount of carbon we have sequestered on our planet occurs in soils. So it's alive. Is kind of the answer. Yeah, real important part of that.
How are humans changing that profile?
Well, we do a lot of things. The anthropogenic effects, or the effects that people have, we cover it up. We pave it with asphalt and concrete. In that process, we lose infiltration, acres and acres of infiltration where water, rainfall, runoff would typically infiltrate into the ground. Now, all of a sudden, it's going to run off on asphalt and concrete that's totally impermeable. We dig it up and destroy it in a sense that the natural layers that occur, or horizons that occur in a soil, are disrupted. If we take a backhoe and we disrupt it, we've ruined the structure. We've destroyed the integrity of a lot of the microbiology, the ecosystems that occur for the microbes. We've disrupted. And so we have had huge effects. Probably right now, one of the major effects going on is that we're moving into warmer and drier phase of things, and the loss of soil moisture, the loss of water within the soils, turns out to be maybe one of the major challenges that we will face. And I think this year in particular might be one of them where some of that will be highlighted as we look at the severe droughts in the western U.S.
I know on a really local basis, when I was growing up in a small town here in northern Utah, I remember leaving for a little while and coming back, and the town square had been scraped to level it out. And I noticed at least for the next 8 to 10 years that the grass would hardly even grow because they had scraped up the subsoil. And even in my own garden, before we moved in, somebody had tried to level it out a little bit. And so I've had to continue to add organic matter to try to make up for a certain area of the garden that just doesn't want to grow as well as others.
Yeah, this happens again and again, and there's natural processes that will do the same thing. We can get heavy snowpack in the winter followed by warm spring rains in the mountains that will cause severe flooding, and that flooding and runoff can strip the mountain slopes of the soils that are there. So it's, one of the things that's kind of important is that soils within at least the time frame of our lifetimes, the natural soils that do occur in the landscapes that we live in pretty much are not renewable. So the carbon that is in the upper part of the dark, carbon-rich part of our forest soils that are there, if we oxidize those in a forest fire or we lose them due to erosion to some event, We will not see those back in place within our lifetime, and maybe very possibly several generations. Now, that's not to say that they won't recover eventually. They will, but the time frames are long enough that it really is kind of a loss of a resource to us. So that's a very common thing. We have a tendency. I know in Las Vegas Valley, if someone owns property, it seems like one of the passages of ownership immediately is that you get a D8 bulldozer and you clear the land, you clear it. And in doing that, you remove a lot of the cover, a lot of the natural pavement and gravels that were there, that were kind of in equilibrium with the wind erosion and the water erosion hit, and everything was locked down. As soon as you go and you scrape out everything and you all disturb it, well, an awful lot of that material is going to be moving downwind. You've lost your cover and your mulch and your protection on that soil. And I don't know what it is with people, but we really like to kind of define ownership by leveling and grading. And it sounds like that's what happened in the small town you grew up.
Well, I've noticed even with new homes, when a new home is being built, for some reason, it just has to be, the yard has to be scraped away. And I don't know if the developer is just selling off that soil elsewhere, but I've seen a lot of homes where just plants just don't grow really well, and I can guess that the subsoil has been brought up.
Yeah, and in urban areas, it's interesting that, you know, different cities and municipalities have different ordinances and rules that they have that they've put in place. So in some places, if you are providing fill, so you build housing projects and you come back in and you do fill, there's pretty tight ordinances on the material I have to bring back in and what you're going to do. And then there's other places where that's not true. You know, there's a lot of variation in how that works across the country. So I have been personally involved in a couple of cases where, you know, these poor folks will plant a tree and, my goodness, they just do everything and they water it and TLC, and it just, you know, goes for about 2 months and croaks, and they put another one in. And I asked at one point, I said, well, have you ever dug down at some depth and taken a look at what the poor tree is growing in? And they said, well, no, we haven't. And I went over and we took a look, and, you know, I dug right down into cinder block and rebar. that they'd use that material to backfill and a fill, and so they were taking construction debris and using that for fill. And obviously not a good material for roots and things to grow in. And that leads you to the thought that a lot of the gravels and cobbles and stones that occur, particularly if you're trying to do things in a built environment, an urban environment, those really are just reducing the volume of soil that you have that's available. So the water supplying capacity of that soil is just simply reduced by exactly the amount of volume of rock that you have in there. And so you just have less of it. So you might only need 4 feet of soil if you have 50% rock fragments in there. Now you need 8 feet of that same material to have the same volume. And so that's another important issue that we've run into with people who are modifying soils or trying to grow in urban environments, that they've run into that.
Why don't you address some of the soil forming factors? I mean, we can, if nature were doing things on its own, how would the soil be come about? And you're saying it takes a couple of generations for that to happen.
Well, and it depends on the soil that you look at, of course. I mean, there are soils that are very, very low in development. In fact, some that have no development. And those are as old as the last time there was a deposit off of a river flood, say. So you know, that's a young soil. There is really no development in it. And we call those intersoils. But in the forming factors, I think the easiest way, there's five factors of soil formation, and they were primarily, this was a concept that was cobbled together by Hans Jenning at Cal Berkeley, the pedologist at Cal Berkeley. And I've often just thought of them as big dials or rheostats that we can turn and adjust, and you have five dials. And if you turn the five dials, they come out the same on all the way you turned them. It wouldn't matter if you were in central Idaho or South Island, New Zealand, then you would expect that you would get a very similar soil that would form, very similar. So this is critical in our understanding of the occurrence of soils across landscapes, is understanding those factors that impact what soils will form where. And so the first factor is climate, rainfall, and temperature. And as important maybe as the total amount of rainfall is also really important is the frequency of occurrence or when the rain falls. So we have, you know, snowpack and a runoff in the spring and a green up and then dry. Or, like in a lot of the southwestern part of the United States, we have summer monsoons. And so we're getting, you know, 35-40% of our annual moisture is coming during the summertime when things are actively growing. So it's the rainfall frequency of that rainfall and temperature that are these climatic variables, and that's one of our factors. The other is the composition of the material that is the source material for the soil, the parent material. So that depends on the geology of the material that you have, and it kind of makes sense that something that has a limestone parent material would end up having a lot of calcium carbonate as a component in the soil that would form, and in fact that's true, as opposed to, say, maybe granite. And so the composition that we start with kind of sets you on a trajectory of minerals and those things that are going to weather and break down and form as a result of that parent material, and so that's another of the soil-forming factors.
So in relation to our western soils, then, is that one of the reasons why you see more fertile soils nearer the mountains than maybe out away from the mountains, because you have just the composition of the rock that has over time disintegrated? I mean, I, for instance, in southern Cache County, there's an area that has a higher pH, and the only thing I can figure out is because he's on an alluvial fan from former Lake Bonneville.
Yeah, that's a good observation, and I think that can be true, although fans usually are the material that's eroding from the mountains, you know. So there's a lot of, maybe a lot of similarity in, a fan Piedmont or a fan surface that has been filling into a basin, in that it's coming from the bedrock that's up on the mountain, which geology could be complex. You could have a mixture of stuff. Probably more likely the answer to it being different as you get closer to the mountain, or at least equally, is the next factor, which is topography. Hmm. So slope and the aspect and the elevation that you're at begins to have an enormous difference. So all of these five factors, we kind of like boxes and keeping things apart. However, they do interrelate, as they often things do, and so they're not completely separate. So there's a really strong relationship in the western United States with elevation and rainfall. And as we go higher, we are wetter. There's also a very strong correlation between elevation and temperature. And as we go higher, we're colder. So as you get closer to the mountain front and you begin to gain elevation, you're going to become wetter, and your temperatures are going to become lower, and so the amount of water that you lose due to evapotranspiration is less. So I guess you could look at that as being the water supplying capacity of the landscape has changed due to the topography. So you have a difference that's really a climatic difference, but it's related to the topography. Aspect, real important, the south face of a 30% slope gets an awful lot of sunlight, gets a lot of insulation from the sun, so it's warmer and it's drier than exactly at the same place on a north aspect. So you get these microclimates that are very, very different in an area that the total amount of rainfall is the same. But it's the actual aspect and the slope that then causes this microclimatic difference, and they actually, the water supplying capacity of those two sites are very different.
So would you say that overall, as you look across the country, that the fertility of the soil goes up in relation to the amount of moisture that soil receives?
Well, water is our magic solvent on our planet. There's no question. But you could go overboard. You could go to where you're so wet that you now are leaching all of the nutrients out of the system. And so maybe not so much in the western U.S., but if we were to take that idea and we go south into the tropics and we take a look at these soils that have humongous amounts of rain and have for a very long time near the equator, they're completely bleached of any nutrients, and there are oxisols, and these are very, very infertile soils. And these are soils that the whole ecosystem is dependent upon just the thin layer of organic matter that's detritus and litter from the vegetation growing on it. So when we cut it off and we do clear cut on it, we remove that source of carbon, and you get 1, maybe 2 years of production, and then you almost end up with sterile ground. So it does kind of depend. The Pacific Northwest and a lot of areas throughout the West. Another causative factor that's really important is volcanic ash. So the amorphous glass is a magic substance that maintains a rather coarse texture, which allows for good water infiltration. You know, water can infiltrate easily, but it has phenomenal water-holding and fertility properties. So you get this good permeable material that has very high fertility and has very good drainage properties. And thus the forests that we have, the natural forests we have in the Pacific Northwest, are the highest producing forests on the planet, best in the world.
I'm also thinking of the Snake River Plain, and at least fertility, being able to grow potatoes is that hold true for that area as well, even though it's dry, a little bit drier?
Well, yeah, and so there now you may have that potential. You know, you might have. The volcanic glass is available there, but without the water, then you're limited. You know, so it really just comes back to whichever one of the factors it is for the plant assemblage that you're desiring to grow. Always there's something that'll be a limiting factor. You finally will run into whatever that is that may not allow everything to happen at an optimum rate or an amount. And of course, the answer to that is, of course, we then have agronomic fields and greenhouses, and we see to it that all those factors are supplied.
Well, Douglas Merkler is my guest today. He's a resource soil scientist for Southern and Eastern Nevada with USDA and Natural Resources Conservation Service. He is giving a webinar this coming Tuesday from noon to 1 p.m., and if you want some information on that webinar, it's just go to forestry.usu.edu. The title of it is Soil Basics and How Utah is Adapting. So why don't you talk about your presentation on Tuesday. How is Utah adapting?
Well, you know, the adaptation, whenever we add that word to it, I come back to the very last forming factor, actually, and that's the biotic factors. Not the last, actually, we had one more. But so, you know, this is the plants and animals and microbes that are all involved in these natural systems. But the big one in there, and I don't mean to imply we're not an animal, but I mean the big one in there is us. We are a huge causative factor. So where we had, as an example, maybe the drainage, the axial drainage in Las Vegas Valley started out with, 2-3 CFS in the wintertime flow. Now averages 275 cubic feet per second as an average flow. And so that's an enormous difference that humans have caused in a system. And obviously there's been, erosion as a result of that, and then engineering and mitigation of that. And that story that's specific to that area is actually told again and again throughout the West. We have enormous impacts. I don't think there's any place where we haven't had an impact. So an adapting is us adapting then really in management techniques that we are going to consider and apply to these soil systems that we are desperately in need of the ecosystem services that soils provide. We really need for them to continue to provide those services for us. Soils are the key to clean water and ultimately clean air, to food source for us. So this is a really, really valuable resource for us to maintain. And you can think of it as a healthy soil health. And you could replace health with function. So it behooves us then to adapt to maintain our management systems so that we are keeping soils functioning properly, and thus we're maintaining ecosystem services that they provide for us.
So what would you say then what do we do to keep them properly functioning?
Well, we probably should take a look at the most fertile land that we have and not build homes on it. So there really hasn't been a concept, you know, if the ground was flat and we had an opportunity, we generally develop and build on it. And in a lot of places, we've lost some of the absolutely prime ground we have for producing food, for producing the resources that we need. So we need to be thoughtful about that a little bit, I think. I don't think you go backwards much, but I think in going forward that we need to be really thinking about that. We need to have a place for floodplains and wetlands to occur, that they're important. The wet soils and the wet systems we have are the filters we have in our systems. So we need to not drain them, and we need to not reduce their size. We need to set them aside and allow them to function and do the stuff that they do so well. And that's to filter all of our systems and kind of act as filters. And the acres of loss per year of wetlands in the country is staggering. I don't have a number offhand, I don't remember, but I know that it's not a good number, and it's something that's a problem that we really need to be aware of.
Well, and historically speaking, the percentage that we have now of wetlands compared to what it was 200 years ago, it's very small.
It is. That's true.
So, regionally speaking, where do you think the tipping point is? I mean, at some point, if we're not taking care of the soils and we just keep building and building, I mean, how far in the future, use your prognosticator there and figure out, you know, how far in the future do we keep going as we are right now without changing?
I don't really have that answer. I don't know how far. I think some of the things that we're kind of finding out and we're in discovery is that thresholds that we cross, some are recoverable. Some we can change what we do and we can go back across those thresholds. And some of them we cannot. Some of them are lost with the exception of incredible resources put in to recover them. And so I don't think we know where all of those are. And so it's a little bit challenging. I mean, there isn't really a magic crystal ball that we have to look into. But we could pay attention. I think if I had one piece of advice that I would have, it would be many, many people seem to race to answers. And I would suggest that what we need to do is to slow down a tiny bit and really critically think about it and ask the right questions. Because I think sometimes we react faster than we really thought about what the real questions are. And had we done that, we'd end up in a better place.
In your experience, what would you say is the number one mistake that people make when putting plants in, whether you're a developer, whether you're a homeowner, you know, whatever your reason for putting in plants, what's the number one mistake that the people do with regards to the soil? And then the second part of this question is, what's the number one thing that people can do to improve the soil health?
Well, that's a really good question. And if we're talking about planting, we can't really exclude the plant side of that. So one of the issues is a lot of plants that people buy, if they were better shoppers, they wouldn't buy plants in pots that were root-bound and in poor condition to start with. And that sounds like a really simple thing, but I believe that that's probably epidemic. And so there's a lot of failure that happens in plantings that the poor little guys are kind of doomed at the start because of the conditions of the roots in the pots. And if people were really careful about that and looked at that and did not buy the ones that were really root-bound, then after a bit, and they wouldn't be producing them anymore if they couldn't sell them. So then it would change the way that happens.
I would expect that selection would also be in there as far as the type of plant you're putting in. For instance, don't even consider growing blueberries in Utah.
No, that's really true, you know, and you don't want to be in Las Vegas and try to grow aspen, right? I mean, and that seems like common sense, but sometimes somebody comes from someplace and they have their heart set on something that they're used to, and they in fact try to do that, and usually it's an experience where they find that they just really aren't capable of. So being very aware, and generally, you know, throughout the country, there's extension service and universities. I believe that there's a lot of resources that are there. Department of Agriculture, my own agency, the NRCS, have a lot of information that are available and are really happy when people come and ask to provide some assistance in species selection. What plants grow well here? And I think very often Extension Service has excellent comments and ideas and have lists of those plants that do really good in that area. So number one, that would really help a lot to do that. Number two is know what you're planting in. I mean, take a look. If you dig down and you have cinder block and rebar, know that you have a problem, right? I mean, that's kind of a common sense thing. Water, just the amount that you need. Overwatering has consequences that are as severe, if not more severe, than underwatering. And underwatering has its own problems, obviously, with stress on the plants. So I think there, it really helps to kind of have an idea of what the water holding is of the soil that you're planting in, and to develop kind of an irrigation management scenario that's appropriate for the soil type that you have, and for the amount of evaporation that you have in the area that you are, and to balance those two things and develop an irrigation management scheme that's appropriate.
Okay. I appreciate you taking the time to join us. You've been listening to Douglas Merkler. He's a resource soil scientist from Southern and Eastern Nevada with USDA and Natural Resources Conservation Service. He is presenting at a webinar, and information for the webinar is at forestry.usu.edu. It's titled Soil Basics and How Utah is Adapting. It's this Tuesday from noon to 1 p.m. So again, just go to forestry.usu.edu for more information. Dr. Merkler, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams in for Petals and Prose. And today I'd like to read you from another essay from one of my favorite authors, from one of my favorite books. This is from Sue Hubbell's book, A Country Year. Sue Hubbell, you may remember from the past, is a 50-year-old ex-librarian and a beekeeper and a self-taught naturalist who lives by herself in the Missouri Ozarks and writes about them. So when I read about honey, I'm usually reading from her book, too. This is just about spring, and I'm kind of antsy for spring right now. You probably are, too. So she just begins her spring section with this essay. The river to the north of my place is claimed by the U.S. Park Service, and the creek to the south is under the protection of the Missouri State Conservation Department. So I am surrounded by government land. The deed to the property says my farm is 105 acres, but it's probably something more like 90. The land hasn't been surveyed since the mid-1800s, and it's hard to know where the boundaries are. A park ranger told me he suspected that the 19th century surveyor had run his lines from a tavern because the corners seemed to have been established by someone in his cups. The place is so beautiful that it nearly brought tears to my eyes the first time I saw it 12 years ago. I feel the same way today, so I have never much cared about the number of acres or where the boundary lines run or who exactly owns what. But the things that make it so beautiful and desirable to me have also convinced others that this is prime land, too, and belongs to them as well. At the moment, for instance, I am feeling a bit of an outsider, having discovered that I live in the middle of an indigo bunting ghetto. As ghettos go, it is a cheerful one in which to live, but it has forced me to think about property rights. Indigo buntings are small but emphatic birds. They believe that they own the place, and it's hard to ignore their claim. The male birds, brilliant, shimmering blue, perch on the garden posts or on top of the cedar trees that have taken over the pasture. From there, they survey their holdings and belt out their songs, complicated tangles of couplets that waken me first thing in the morning. They keep it up all day, even at noon, after the other birds have quieted. The indigo buntings have several important facts to tell us, especially about who's in charge around here. The dull brown sparrow-like females and juveniles are more interested in eating. They stay nearer the ground and search the low-growing shrubs and grasses for seeds and an occasional caterpillar, but even they know what's what. One day, walking back along the edge of the field, I came upon a young indigo bunting, preoccupied with song practice. He had not yet dared take as visible a perch as his father would have chosen, but there he was, clinging to a bare twig and softly running through his couplets, getting them all wrong and then going back over them so quietly that if I had not been within a few feet of him, I would not have heard. Another time I discovered that the back door of the honey house had blown open, and the room was filled with a variety of winged creatures. Most were insects, but among them I found a half-grown indigo bunting who had blundered in and was trying to find his way out, beating his small wings against the screened window. Holding him carefully, I stroked the back of his neck to try to soothe him, but discovered that his heart was not beating in terror. Perhaps he was so young that he had not learned fear, but I prefer to think that, like the rest of his breed, he was simply too pert and too sure of his rights to be afraid. He eyed me crossly and tweaked my giant thumb with his beak to tell me that I was to let him go right this minute. I did so, of course, and I watched him fly off to all the tall grasses behind the honey house, where I knew that one family of indigo buntings had been nesting. Well, they think they own the place, and their assurance is only countered by a scrap of paper in my files. But there are other contenders, and perhaps I ought to try to take a census and judge claims before I grant them title. There are other birds who call this place theirs. Buzzards, who work the updrafts over the river and creek. Goldfinches, wild turkeys, phoebes, and whippoorwills. But it's a pair of cardinals who have ended up with the prize piece of real estate, the spot with the bird feeder. I have tapes of bird songs, and when I play them, I try to skip the one of the cardinal, because the current resident goes into a frenzy of territorial song when he hears his rival. His otherwise lovely day is ruined. And what about the coyote? For a while, she was confident that this was her farm, especially the chicken part of it. She was so sure of herself that once she sauntered by in daylight and picked up the tough old rooster to take back to her pups. However, the dogs grew wise to her, and the next few times she returned to exercise her rights, they chased her off, explaining that this farm belonged to them and that the chicken flock was their responsibility. When I started thinking about it that way, that those who inhabit the land and use it have a real claim to it as in a non-legal sort of a way, the whole question gets complicated. A long time ago, before I came to live in the Ozarks, I spent a springtime working on a plot of university research land. I was young and in love, and most tasks seemed happy ones, but the project would have captured my fancy anyway. There were three contrasting habitats being studied: upland forest, bottomland, and sandy waste. My job was to dig up a cube of earth from each place every week, sift it, count, and rough classify the inhabitants visible to the naked eye, and then plot the population growth. The resulting curve, a joyous, vibrant freshening of life, matched the weather and my own pulse beat. That particular love has quieted, and I have not excavated cubes of earth on this place, but I know what is going on down there. Millions of little bodies are fiercely metabolizing and using the land. I dare not even think what numbers I would come up with if I added a pocket lens or microscope to my census-taking tools. But there are other residents I can count who do have arguable title here. There are 20 hives of bees back by the woodlot in my home bee yard, each hive containing some 60,000 bees. That makes 1,200,000 bees, their souls flitting about making claim to all the flowers within 2 miles. On the other hand, there are the copperheads, who make walking the fields a boot affair, and all of their snakish kin. How am I to count them and judge their claims? There are the turtles, who eat the strawberries in the garden, the peepers who own the pond. What about raccoon and skunk and deer rights? What about the bobcat, who denned in the cliff by the river and considers my place to be the nearest, merest sliver of her own? It begins to make me dizzy, even trying to think of taking a census of everybody who lives here, and all of them seem to have certain claims to the place that are every bit as good, and perhaps better, than mine. Up the road there's a human squabble going over some land less happily situated. Rather than lying between two environmentally benign government stakeholders, that land and all that surrounds it is in private land. One owner wants to bulldoze and develop, and so the boundary question is becoming a sticky one. There is talk about having an expensive survey made to establish who owns what. As a spin-off, I suppose that corners will be set and lines will be run, and then I may know whether this farm is 105 acres or 90 or some other definity. The Indigo Buntings probably won't care. And that is Sue Hubbell's Country Year, and I am Nancy Williams. See you next time.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and for our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment today, Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, is in studio. And what's our tree today, Mike?
We debated this, but Norway maple, I think.
Okay. Now, that's quite a lot to say, since there are many towns in this state that are lined with Norway maples.
Yeah. And there's a couple of aspects here. For one thing, it's a little bit of a weed, even in Utah. In the northeastern U.S., they can't believe we allow people to plant it because it's a declared legally noxious weed in some places in the Northeast.
Well, in my backyard, if I don't get them out, they grow everywhere. I used the one as a 4 or 5 of them came up, and I used it as a screen, as a hedge almost, until they started getting too big, and then I finally took them all out. But they just come up pretty easily.
And they are up some of our canyons. I don't think they're, given how long they've been here and how relatively little they've spread up into the canyons, I don't worry too much about them becoming a big problem. In Utah, the only trees really that are commonly declared noxious weeds are Russian olive and tamarisk, which is a shrub to a small tree. Norway maple is not a declared noxious weed here, so it is legal to grow it. So it's the weediness bothers me a little, and it's just that there are better maples, and it tends to not age well. You get a lot of limbs dying, and you don't know why. And I'm very familiar with this tree. I have 7 of them.
I'm taking it you did not plant these
no,
trees.
No, I didn't, but they're so important in terms of where they're placed.
So it didn't deter you when you were looking at this house?
No, it was beautiful, actually. But living with Norway maples, what do they say? Familiarity breeds contempt. Huh. I've had probably 5 of them suffer severely from girdling roots, which is really common in Norway maples, more so than many other species of trees, where the roots kind of go sideways when they come out from the trunk and cross over one another. And then when the trunk grows in diameter, the base of the trunk, and the roots start to grow in diameter, the big woody roots, and then there's crossing roots that start to grow in diameter, when they all reach each other, it's the perfect storm, and you end up with the tree starting to decline. And I've got one, I've got six as street trees in my parking strip. There really isn't big enough. It's not a big enough area for them, but I've got them. And I've got one that this year will determine whether I just have to remove it or not, because I've twice done a root color excavation with a trowel and a shop vac and cut roots that were girdling other roots. And hopefully this year it'll start to come back. It'll take a few years.
That's the hard thing about those. If you do cut them down, it's going to take a long time to replace the shade. So I'm assuming that's why you haven't been keeping them that long.
Yeah. And if I do replace it, I think I'll come behind the curb on my side of the curb, because I only have about a 40-inch planting strip from curb to sidewalk.
That's a great spot for native perennials that don't need any extra water.
Right, yeah. So. And then get my trees behind the sidewalk. It'd still be a hard decision, though, because I'd still have five left, and some of them are, the biggest one is probably 20 inches in diameter.
And then the other problem is the insects. Every year, except maybe last year, in my place, I've had aphid problems. You can just see the leaves shining with the honeydew from the aphids. And I told my son, I says, "Yeah, that's aphid poo."
Yeah,
and like,
aphids
really?
Are really bad this year.
They're terrible
on Norway maple and lindens, especially, but even on some pines and it's really bad. And but aphids by themselves wouldn't be enough to make the decision for me to not plant it, but it's more the dieback that it's prone to, you know, especially any dieback that opens up part of the trunk or a large branch to direct sunlight that hasn't had direct sunlight in a while. It just seems like it doesn't do well. And you make a pruning wound on the west or the south side of a tree and it gets direct sun, you know, what might be a 4-inch diameter pruning wound will die way back before it'll finally start making the callus and heal it over. So that's the main problem with Norway maples to me. And I know a lot of people have them, and I'd be interested to know how many of people who have them, what proportion like them when they've been with them for a while.
But they're not being used any longer, or recommended anyway, by cities to put in along the street. They're doing other ones now.
There probably are still a number of cities that are on acceptable plant lists. And really, in terms of Norway maple, it's an okay tree. We have enough. And so part of the reason I'd be saying don't plant any of them is don't plant any more. Mm. We have plenty. It'll take a while till the proportion of the tree population that is Norway maples gets down to a reasonable proportion. You'd like to not have more than 10% of the trees in a town or city be any one species, in case something happens like the Dutch elm disease did with the American elm.
Well, you look at Logan's Main Street, and there were maples up and down Main Street. And now, at least on the south end of town, they were just starting to die back and not looking very good. And the city has taken them all out and replaced them with London Plane.
Right, and that's the dieback I'm talking about.
Okay.
And actually, the old quad here on campus has mostly is tree-lined with Norway maples, and over the next several years, we're phasing that to, in this case, it's going to be London Plains, and then London Plain will be pretty much reserved for that place on campus.
And London Plains are also known as?
Sycamore by a lot of people, yeah. And so we have enough. they're okay trees, but we have enough, and we don't need more.
So for today's Wait, Don't Plant That segment, the recommendation is don't plant Norway maples. Now, can you plant Rocky Mountain maples in their place?
Yeah, actually.
Since that is a native.
I think the one you're probably talking about is Canyon maple or Big Tooth
big
maple.
Big Tooth, yeah.
Rocky Mountain maple is actually another species of maple native to Utah that doesn't get very big. It's kind of small and shrubby, and it would be fine. But
so the Big Tooth maple would be okay?
Yeah, it has good fall color. Really
better than Norway. Norway.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the only thing with Big Tooth maple is currently there's only one named cultivar that's been, you know, grafted and is genetically selected. And unfortunately, the wholesaler grafts them onto Acer rubrum, which is red maple rootstocks from the eastern U.S., and they do okay here, but they don't get all that good a fall color. And but it is a more tree form, upright tree form.
So does the rootstock affect the color of the leaves that much?
I think so.
Wow.
In that case, it does, I think. And they know that it might do better on some other rootstock, but they're just red maple works well for them to grow for rootstocks. So that's what they do. But they are looking at some other Big Tooth maple cultivars. That particular wholesaler is, and actually USU's been involved with getting them some new selections.
So we'll be looking forward to having those.
Yes.
Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment with Mike Coons, USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. And you can go online and get some great information with the Tree Browser. And that's produced through Utah State University. And what's the address, Mike?
Just treebrowser, all one word, .org.
Thanks, Mike. And thank you for joining us on today's edition of The Zesty Garden. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.